Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Talking Taste Buds. I'm your host, Venetia Falconer, and if you're new here, please do share, subscribe, rate, and review. It makes such a difference in helping me get the word of the podcast out there. This week, I'm chatting to Swati Deepak. Swati is a global expert and champion of girls' rights. She has advised UN agencies, governments, private foundations, and high net worth individuals on girls' rights and gender equality strategies. She has been instrumental in increasing resources to girls most in need around the world, and she's the director of With and For Girls. The With and For Girls Collective is a group of organisations that share the common belief that girls are vital agents of change. They regard grassroots, girl-led and girl-centred organisations supported by flexible funding as propellers for transformational change towards a more equitable world. In this interview, we discuss how being more conscious of intersectional feminist change can be one of the biggest forces for transformative environmental impact.
We know that educating girls is the right thing to do. It's the right thing for girls, it's the right thing for society, and it's a great thing for the planet, but we're just not doing it.
We focus on the fashion industry and how it appears to be taking advantage of feminism as a trend in the same way it is sustainability.
Feminism is fashionable at the moment, but yet the actual industry of fashion is not feminist.
Swati is also highly passionate about food, as you will hear as soon as she shares how she broke her fast. But let us start as we always do. What did you have for breakfast?
So I had hot water. I think we were both talking about our love for just hot water. So I had hot water this morning and I had papaya and I had an Indian flatbread called a thepla, which is, I'm gluten intolerant. So it's a gluten-free bit of bread that's flavoured with lots of spices and fenugreek leaves, and it's delicious.
That sounds amazing. I had papaya this morning too.
Did you? Yeah. I love it. Papaya season. It's one of my favourite fruits.
Do you have it with lime? Fresh lime on top.
I actually eat it with my flatbread, which is a bit weird.
Oh no, nice.
But it's like, I love the spicy and the sweet together.
God, that sounds like the best breakfast. So let's talk growing up. Where did you grow up, and was food a big feature of your childhood? Who did the cooking in your family, and what are your kind of strongest memories of food?
So I grew up between Delhi in India and London in the UK, and food is massive in Indian culture and in my family in particular. So grew up with lots and lots of food associations. One of the first things that happens when a baby is born, especially in my family, is that the moment a baby is born, a finger is dipped in honey, and then Om is written on the tongue of the baby as well, just to kind of bring in the sweetness of life and just celebrate kind of this child coming into the world. And so, you know, that kind of taste starts from day one of exploring different foods. And there's quite a lot of rituals associated to as you grow up. There's certain rituals of when you have rice for the first time or when you have lentils for the first time. So yeah, food is, it plays like an important junction at every stage. Whenever it's a good occasion, there's always Indian sweets or something sweet distributed, and it's about preventing the evil eye. So if you're trying to celebrate something, you have something sweet, and it stops anybody from saying anything negative that would bring like the evil eye and potentially, you know, bring about ill fate or ill luck to like the people around you. The cooking was done mainly by my mum and my grandmothers and my aunts. So in Delhi, big extended family households, lots of different kids running around everywhere, grandparents, aunts, uncles, parents, all in one house together. And yeah, lots of everything was sort of sourced, and is still, whenever I go back to India or and with my parents, everything is sort of made from scratch. So as you know, as you may know, or as other listeners may know, you know, my family is Hindu and the cow is sacred. So you don't eat beef, but you celebrate the gifts of the cow, which include the milk. And so milk is like brought from little dairy farms. You make fresh yogurt from the milk every morning and you leave it out. You churn the unpasteurized milk as well into homemade butter. You know, you buy your spices fresh, they're all ground fresh for you. You buy everything from local mills. Even now, I think, even though you've got stores and like Walmarts in India, I think most of my family and most of my friends still buy from they're kind of like their family flour guy and the family spice man and the family X. And you go to these people and you pick up fresh ingredients. And yes, it's like mainly the women who cook, but my dad is a huge foodie. He loves to cook. So he's really good at making snacks and just making like just delicious food. So I grew up with just a real keen interest in food and in eating and talking about food, reading on food, eating food, all the food. And just was really lucky. Indian food is so diverse. Like every state has got its staple dishes. Everyone's got their own street food. And there's just a wide range of different foods. So like on Mondays, my whole family fasts, so we don't eat certain foods. And it's not a fast in that we don't eat anything. There's certain foods that you can't have, so meats and dairies are out. And so is anything that comes from a grain. So anything from wheat, rice, things like lentils and pulses are also out as well. So you end up spending like Mondays just having fruits. And there's loads of flours and flatbreads that you can make that are just made from fruit flours. Wow. So you get grounded fruit flours, lotus root stem flour, and you can still make like roti or chapatis or parantas like from these. And then Tuesdays, most people are vegetarian as well. So there's this sort of order that comes with being in a family like that. Everyone kind of shares food and shares this sort of coming together on a daily basis, which is lovely and something that I've tried to continue, obviously living alone and trying to recreate all those recipes. And I feel like I'm constantly on the phone to like my mom or my dad or my aunts, or calling up my grandma if possible, and just getting recipes from all of them.
I love that. That's the best way to get recipes that are passed down.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about your career. What did you want to be when you were younger, and what were you kind of encouraged to do by your parents?
I wanted to work in something that was going to help people. I always knew that. And first of all, I thought being a nurse or being a teacher would be great for that. But then I wasn't very good at teaching. I wasn't very good at blood or the sight of blood. But I knew I wanted to help. And I think I was just really encouraged. My father had always been a business and in business. But my mum was a yoga teacher and taught cooking.
Cool.
And she sort of segued from working within yoga and working sort of on Ayurveda, which is like a type of healing through what you're consuming or what you're eating. And she sort of moved from that to looking at holistic ways to support people. So she worked in the sort of late 80s with people who had HIV and AIDS, just around not just what they faced going through HIV and AIDS, but also how holistic therapies and ways of eating and types of healing practices that are known around the world to other cultures could be brought and embedded into British like systems. So she worked a lot with the NHS on getting different types of, I guess, more holistic therapies recognized within the NHS system.
And wow, what amazing work.
I know. And I think she's one of like many people who campaigned for things that we now treat as normal in terms of the way that we access healthcare here, but things like getting acupuncture or physiotherapy, those were sort of unheard of or a little bit too hippie-ish, yeah. I think, back in the day. But now they are part of the way that we access healthcare. So I think I saw what my mum was doing and I was like, I really want to do that. And I was sort of, remember on HIV rallies being like, I don't know, 11 or 12 and carrying boxes of condoms around, and my mum talking about safe sex and different sex couples. And so it made me really think about how could I have an impact and how could I have an impact to communities that mean so much. Mm. And I think what I was really lucky about, just to your point on the expectations, I think the expectations from a lot of Indian families is, you know, you be successful, you educate yourself, and then you get married. So there's quite a lot of patriarchal norms that are put on you. You know, your value as a woman is looking a certain way, educating yourself to attract the right guy, and then getting married and settling down and kind of having babies. But I was really lucky. My parents have always encouraged all of those things, to be independent, to educate yourself. But it hasn't been necessarily tied to doing that for the benefit of men. And so I think my step into working has really been around pursuing justice for communities, specifically young people, but much more over the last few years has been working in a lot of feminist or women and girls rights issues, which is something I feel deeply passionate about because I come from a culture where that is deeply embedded.
Mm. So you're currently the director for With and For Girls.
Yes.
Tell us all about this job and what it entails.
So With and For Girls is super, super exciting. And I think me and my team often say we're like the luckiest people in the world to have the job that we do. So With and For Girls is a collective of 9 different funders. Funders being foundations and individuals who have made an intention that they will spend X amount of money per year helping good causes. And so the job of foundations or funders is to get money to people who need it, for, you know, the alleviation of poverty, for increasing women and girls' rights to access gender justice. And so the 9 organizations that got together, which is STARS Foundation, Comic Relief, Global Fund for Children, Empower, Nike Foundation, Novo Foundation, and Purposeful Productions, and Plan International UK, we all got together. And it was at a time, actually, in 2014, there was a lot of stats around girls. And, you know, 1 in 10 girls have experienced sexual harassment in their life. 1 in 5 girls around the world are denied their right to an education. When we look across all of the things that are impacting poverty in the world, girls at the absolute bottom of that mix. And sadly, even though girls are the ones that are not accessing healthcare in the right way, not getting education, they're the ones who are victims of violence. Only 2 cents, less than 2 cents of every dollar of any funding that goes to aid and to the benefit of humans around the world, only less than 2 cents of every dollar goes to girls. Mm. And so there was a real big call to action at the time that the British government led, and they hosted a girls' summit to present these factors and say, what are we going to do about it? We need to change this tide. And so the collective was formed at that stage, which was, you know, we want to get our funding and get it to girls directly. And in the formation of it, we realized that actually girls have always been organizing. They're the victims of all of these different types of injustices, but adolescent girls around the world are not victims and they're not hopeless. And when you look at like an image like Malala, you think, or Greta Thunberg, you think about, wow, like these amazing, young, empowered, strong girls. And the reality is there are like thousands, if not millions, like them all around the world who are working together to try and change the world for themselves and change the world for others. So we came together as a collective. We run an awards program every year. So we receive nominations from groups that are led by girls. So some of the organizations that we give funding to, for instance, are the oldest person is 17, and the whole organization is just adolescent girls who are fighting for their rights in rural Kyrgyzstan or in Mali or in Samoa or even in the UK. And what we do is we go through a process by getting all these nominations from around the world in. And I think just to also say that it is a global award, because there isn't any country where it's better to be a girl than it is to be a boy. Girls are severely impacted. And I remember reading a report from Plan, actually, that even in the UK, even a girl born right now today will still earn less over her lifetime than a boy born at the exact same moment. And that's 2019. So we wanted to recognize that, A, we want to get funding directly to girls and to girl issues around the world. Secondly, that we wanted to recognize groups that were being led by girls, or they were really centered around girls. They could be bigger organizations that are run by adults or work on multi-issues like boys, wider gender, wider poverty issues, but the programs that have girls in are actually led by girls. And then what's really great is, you know, philanthropy has this power dynamic. I hold money and power and I'm giving it to an organization and saying I'm rewarding you for doing that. And we really wanted to flip that power balance. So our rewards are, we put the decision making in the hands of girls. And so we recruit panels of adolescent girls in each of the five regions of the world. They are trained on issues that affect girls in their region. So the girls in Nepal, for instance, get an understanding of what it's like to be a girl in Mongolia or in the Philippines or in India. And then they will interview all the shortlisted organizations, and they will interview the girls in those organizations, and they then decide who wins an award and therefore who gets our funding. So it's about trying to shift the power and about bringing girls into that position. So I get to go to a lot of events to talk about what we're doing and meet with other funders and encourage them to do the same. I work with an incredibly passionate team who are just deeply, deeply committed to getting girls this funding. And I think the most inspiring thing is I get to literally on a daily basis be schooled by adolescent girls who know their realities way more than we would ever give them credit for. And some of the conversations that I have with girls are so deeply critical and so deeply informed that you just wonder why no one else is listening to girls. Like, if we just listen to girls, what a difference the world could be. But they're just denied that, right? They're not brought to the table in so many situations. But I was in Nepal a few weeks ago, and we had a number of winners from like Chicago, from Nepal, from Kenya, who were there for a big feminist conference. And some of the 16-year-old girls that you meet, you know, their lives have been impacted just because they're a girl. You know, they're denied a right to education. They're denied their rights. They're forced into child marriages. You know, they've been raped, harassed, gone through inexplicable issues and injustices, and yet their resilience and their resolve to change the world for themselves and change it for others is so incredibly inspiring. Like, you can't help but feel, oh my God, my job is to get you resources and to take a microphone so other people's like can actually hear what you're doing and your voice is amplified. And what an honor that is for me and my team to be a part of that.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Recently, it was announced that educating girls was the sixth best way to reduce emissions and halt climate change, according to a plan by Project Drawdown. Why is the issue of educating females so integral to reducing our impact on the planet?
You know, I think what Project Drawdown has really shown is that, you know, we talk about wind turbines, we talk about electric cars, and yet educating girls is way more powerful in reducing carbon emissions than both of those things combined. I think that's, you know, a really exciting thing. And the reason is that, you know, girls who are actually get to go to school, not only are you giving them the right to be able to travel and go to school and be educated, we know that girls over their lifetime will reinvest the majority of their funding back into, or the majority of their earnings, sorry, back into the local community. We know that just by educating girls, what happens is they're less likely to have a child marriage. They're less likely to get pregnant. And we also know that those are huge factors in not just denying girls their rights, but the impact, the knock-on impact that that has for the environment. You know, actually being able to be educated enough to delay your marriage, delay your birth of your children, and to know that you can space your children out and not have child after child after child, that also has a huge knock-on impact on the environment. We know we're an overcrowded planet already. And similarly, we know that 220 million women and girls around the world want contraception, but they don't have access to it. So you've got huge span of people that are giving birth and are going through issues way earlier than they should be, but enabling them to have an education gives them some sort of negotiating factor to actually stop that happening. It also allows them to be able to access different types of livelihood that enable their own empowerment, but also to think about how that they can use their resources effectively for their local community in a much more powerful way. It also gives them the autonomy to be able to understand and negotiate different kind of economic and social factors in their community. So all in all, we know that educating girls is the right thing to do. It's the right thing for girls, it's the right thing for society, and it's a great thing for the planet, but we're just not doing it. Mm-hmm. Just a couple of stats that I thought would be really important is the UN, UNICEF, WHO, and the Journal of Consumer Research all did research that actually proves that women outperform men in environmental behavior. So women are recycling more, they're consuming less meat, they are doing all the types of environmental behavior in a better way than men are. And I think a lot of that reason is because under the patriarchy, women are selfless, they're community orientated, they're socially minded, and also toxic masculinity. If a man displays lots of green actions, it may brand them too feminine. And so I think that's a huge factor. Mm. I think the second issue is that, again, we know from statistics from the UN that 80% of people displaced by climate change are women and girls. So despite the fact that they're the ones doing the less to impact the environment, they're the ones that are impacted more when things go wrong. And they are actually 14 times more likely than men to face a risk of death from climate-related disasters as well. And then the third stat that I thought was really important for this conversation as well was that women are completely underrepresented in the fight against climate change. So if you look at any government makeup of who the decision makers are, there are way more men than there are women. In any decision-making body around climate change around the world, right from the very top, the UN Climate Commission, all the way down to other committees, women represent one or two seats on those. So women are completely misrepresented at every level of not just being impacted by climate change, but even having a say in what we can do to change it. And I think we all need to recognize that so that we can amplify women's voices and get them seats at those tables.
Let's talk a little bit about the trend of feminism. A really interesting term that you raised before we stopped press record was girl washing.
Yes.
Which is taken from greenwashing. Talk to us a little bit about what girl washing is and how the kind of fashion industry and media are capitalizing on the trend of feminism.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can all see it, especially being in London and going through all the shops. Every brand is talking about, oh, I'm a feminist, and you can buy notebooks and you can buy t-shirts and you can buy keyrings and postcards and pens, and every sort of consumer item is stamped with the label of I'm a feminist.
The future is female.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. All of these things. And the reality is that the term girl washing has come up to apply to lots of different sectors, but particularly with fashion, it's, you know, feminism is fashionable at the moment, but yet the actual industry of fashion is not feminist. And that's the difference, by you believing, yes, girls and women deserve equal rights, or anyone who's even gender non-binary deserves equal rights. But the fact that you're buying a t-shirt from a different store or buying a notebook, like, how was that produced? And if it's just leading to further injustices and further inequalities towards that specific group, are you even really a feminist?
In a similar vein, someone sent me an image of a t-shirt saying there is no planet B on it today. And then someone commented underneath, oh, do you ship to Australia? And they said, yeah, we ship internationally. And I think we're just seeing this more and more, this kind of discrepancy between the slogan of a t-shirt and then how it's being made, who's making it, how far it's traveling. Do you think you can be a feminist and support fast fashion?
Personally, I don't think you can really claim to be a feminist and still consume fast fashion. Fast fashion, its whole essence is about consumption. And, you know, a lot of people talk about capitalism is the reason for that. It's nothing to do with the patriarchy. So capitalism is the one that's going, buy, 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 you need to look this way, you need to buy this to feel good and to get that hit of, I've got something new and shiny and so on and so forth, and appealing to, I guess, that magpie in humans. But the reality is that with that consumption, that overarching consumption, you are draining the world of so many resources in buying something, wearing it once and then throwing it away. Even if it is a t-shirt that claims, you know, I'm a feminist, the future is female, if you're only going to wear that once or twice, you've got to really ask yourself, do you really believe that the future is female if you're just willing to wear a logo that says it? And you're actually not willing to understand all the factors that sit behind fast fashion. What fast fashion is doing is, on one side, it's about turnarounds happening so, so quickly that just puts pressure on the supply chain down the end. You know, the factories that are in Bangladesh, in Guatemala, in Morocco are having to produce thousands and thousands of t-shirts at a moment's notice, so that they're in stores for you to buy in a couple of weeks' time. And that forces bad working conditions. You know, you can't think that there isn't a give somewhere down that line. How is that cotton being made? Who's, you know, those farmers, most of the people in the agricultural industry are women. They're probably working overtime in really bad conditions, probably denied any of their human rights on access to justice, on labor unions, on equal pay, on the timings that they're working on. But they're also, you know, you're forcing them to farm in a certain way. You're then, you know, like dyeing things in a certain way, dyeing it different colors, you're mixing different chemicals. Most of these things are being mixed in other countries around the world that you can't see or see the negative impacts on. You know, chemical dyes, they completely leach like the soil of any worthwhileness. There are, you know, areas of Tamil Nadu in India, I know, that are well known for dyeing jeans. And that runoff of all those chemical dyes has completely decimated the whole water table in like an entire state. You know, people can't grow items anymore. You can't farm that land. That impact, you're literally, that has gone towards poisoning different communities, most of whom are women and girls. You're then coming up to the way that, you know, fast fashion is even marketed. It's appealing to the patriarchy, you know. And we were talking about this earlier, Venetia. You know, fashion is like a trillion, you know, multi-trillion dollar industry. It has to rely on capitalism, like, to get that turn of money coming in and out. And fast fashion is a way of quickly making that money. You can buy 20 t-shirts in a year, even if you only need one. And women are the ones that are marketed to for that. It's like, well, women should look a certain way. You should be wearing new clothes. You should be wearing what's in fashion. We need to, you know, fashion shows used to be like two seasons a year, and now they're like way more, like, I don't know, 10 seasons. It feels like there are new clothes every single time you pass a store. And who are they marketed to from the front? They're always women. You know, we have culottes and shorts and skirts and dresses and thigh length and knee length and floor length, and there's so many things that we're told to consume to look a certain way, to be appealing. And appealing for who? Are we doing it really for ourselves, as individual women? Are we doing it for the wider, like, for acceptance in society, or even acceptance in ourselves? And that's what I mean by, if you're consuming fast fashion, not only are you refusing to recognize the impacts that it has further down the supply chain on those very women and girls that your t-shirt is claiming to support, but also you're appealing to something where you're like, well, I should look a certain way and I should behave a certain way, rather than just a general acceptance of who we are as individuals, of who we are as women, of who we are as non-binary people, you know, as thin, as fat people. You know, we should be just body positive in what we're wearing. And that's the real essence of feminism, is about social acceptance. So I just, from my perspective, I don't think you can be a consumer of fast fashion unless you consume it and you wear that thing for a lifetime.
In a way, it feels like when you wear a slogan t-shirt, it is such a great way to make a statement. You know, some of them are really powerful, and it does feel like such a great way to make a statement. And it's, you know, obviously the better way to make that statement is to not buy. Mm-hmm. Or if you really want something new, go to a charity shop or swap with a friend or rent something. But no one's going to know about the statement that you're making with that purchase or with that secondhand purchase if it doesn't have this awesome slogan on the front. So it's really, really hard, isn't it?
Yeah,
What kind of ways do you think we should be challenging ourselves to kind of subvert the norms and try and be a bit more feminist in our everyday actions when it comes to clothing and what we buy?
I think one of those things is going back to that social acceptance. Why do you want to be seen to be making a statement with your clothes, saying a certain thing? Can you say it in a different way? Or could you even look at, there are so many women and gender equity and gender rights organizations that produce ethical things with slogans that appeal to the work that they're doing. Rather than buying it from Topshop, you could buy, I know the Fawcett Society do some brilliant kind of branded things, and the money from that, all of the actual sourcing of it is ethical, and the production of it is ethical, but the money also goes towards supporting an incredible charity working on women and gender equality here in the UK. You know, there's a way of still being able to consume, but from investing it into something where you are actually lifting up like women and girls' rights or gender non-binary rights. There's also the way of, do I need to say it at all? Can I say it in another way? Can I use my voice? Can I use social media to talk about my feelings about this? Could I even look at printing it myself, like, in an ethical way? Can I look into doing that? And I appreciate people don't have time. I don't have time, you know, to do those kind of things. I think it's only something for people who have that time. But is there just a way that you can feel like you're saying it and you're standing behind the the cause, but you don't have to necessarily wear it emblazoned on a t-shirt.
Lovely. I'd love to talk to you a little bit about the marketing of lots of fast fashion brands and the kind of general feel of the stores at the moment. I only walk into a fast fashion store now to kind of do an Instagram story about why people shouldn't walk in. But I am really noticing when I walk past this kind of like ethereal feeling and it's all very kind of minimal and Swedish, and I'd love to talk to you a little bit about some of the kind of imagery that's being used in these shops and your feelings about how they're kind of marketing the product.
So I think for me, you know, and I was sharing an example earlier, but when you go into some of these fast fashion stores, it's exactly how you say, it's ethereal, it's breezy, it's all white, it's clean. And actually one of the things that I've noticed is this sort of focus in on how it's designed and how it's made, being the proprietor of the brand. So, you know, I was in Another Stories the other day and it says Stockholm Atelier on it, you know, and actually the imagery around the store is white hands cutting the fabric and stitching and so on and so forth. And for me, you know, especially as a person of color, when you look at that, you know that the reality is, yes, that organization is headquartered and the designs are definitely coming from Sweden and there's no denying that. But the fact that there's this sort of illusion portrayed that by being designed and made by fair hands sat in Europe, that there's an equality and that you're buying into something that has, I guess, more of an ethical feel to it, rather than seeing the real conditions and the real people who are making your clothes, who are probably sat in very cramped, probably light denied conditions. In another part of the world, those hands are people of colour's hands. And there's something that's just framed in the way that now you're consuming fashion, because people know that, like fashion being feminism, being ethical is fashionable as well. And so how can your brand create this illusion of being clean, of being doing things the right way, of upholding rights? And you know, Scandinavia is an amazing part of the world for upholding gender equality and upholding gender rights. You know, their whole structure is something that we can aspire to the rest of the world. But the fact is playing on that notion of this great country where things are together, their welfare state works, the people are beautiful and fashionable and on trend. That's being sold to us when we walk into that store, that actually my clothes are being made and conceived of in this beautiful, ethereal, ethical place, where the reality is that it's not. It's still being produced in the same places, I'm sure, that other fast fashion places are also producing their clothes, and it's definitely not being stitched and the patterns are not being cut by white hands. They're being cut by people of color. And I think it just, for me, it really plays into this whole notion of neo-colonialism, that, you know, progression is sat in the global north and poverty and backwardness is sat in the global south of the world. And for me, it's, you know, there's a responsibility to actually market in a way that levels that playing field and doesn't just continue to enforce that kind of background narrative.
So when can fashion be used as a force for good? When can it be used positively? Have you seen instances of fashion being used in a positive way?
So I mean, I think I'm a lover of fashion. I love fashion myself, and you know, I love buying like materials from different stores when I'm traveling for work, and I will get them stitched in a certain way. I will wear them. I get old stuff from my family and friends, and I love clothes. And the reality is, you know, we're not going to, by simply not consuming, we're not going to change, like, you know, as women and girls have always been a part of the fashion industry. They make up 80% of the workforce around the world are women and girls who are in these factories. And, you know, there is something hugely positive about the force for good that fashion can be. You know, the fact that those people are in, they're getting an income, that's huge for equality. You know, that woman who would not have a job within a clothing factory stitching your clothes, for her, you know, that is her form of rights. It is her form of autonomy. The fact that she's earning autonomously, the fact that she's able to get out of the home and work and earn her own money, bank it, all of those things are deeply empowering and can be really empowering for women and girls. But the reality is that at the moment, the fashion industry isn't recognizing all the things that enable her to see that just one job as being lift up. So, you know, she needs to be able to go into a space where she's not going to face harassment, that she is going to be able to work good hours, that her health isn't going to be compromised. There also needs to be wider changes in this, in society, that can be enabled from her working. At the moment, I was saying, you know, she has her own money. The reality is if she hasn't got her rights realized, she will return home to her family and to her partner, and all her money would be stripped from her, and he might deploy it or use it as he sees fit. And actually, her autonomy isn't there. In a lot of countries, women are, they cannot buy land, they cannot hold a bank account. So you also have to work on actually enabling that woman to be able to have that money for herself, and to be able to make decisions on it. And there are many countries where that's not enabled. So I think there's that ability for like the fashion industry as just a huge employer to be able to really change things for women and girls around the world. But also, you know, what I also love about clothing and I love about textiles is just this deep history that exists around the world with it. I know this amazing brand called 1111, which is, you know, based around slow fashion. It's about reviving cottage industries in India through weaving of khadi. And khadi is this old form of cotton weaving that's indigenous to India. And the brand uses biological dyes, natural dyes. It has a seed to stitch model. And those, you know, those kind of models of fashion have like such a transformative effect for everyone in that supply chain. If you're sourcing that cotton from fair trade farms, where again most of the people are women and girls who are working in that, those agricultural plantations, if it's being done without pesticides, you're not, you know, you're not polluting the actual food that they're eating off those same farms or in adjacent farms. If you're weaving things in a traditional way, you're bringing together small communities together into like collective ownership models. And I think another one that I'm really, really excited about is a group called AFEDES, which is an association of indigenous women weavers in Guatemala. And they've been supported by a fellow foundation of ours, Thousand Currents. And what they've recognized is, you know, that there's all these weavers across Guatemala working on that beautiful, really vibrant colors and weaves. And, you know, these are indigenous groups that are really at risk. You know, their rainforests, their living conditions are being completely decimated for profit. They are indigenous groups, we know, are upholders of the climate. They are the ones that are at the front line. Most of them are dying, trying to protect the land from logging, from mining, from deforestation. They're right on the front lines. And one of the things that Angelina, who runs AFEDES from the Guatemalan community, she always says is, you know, textiles and our weaves are the history that the colonizers didn't burn. So many of these ancient civilizations through colonialism have been completely decimated. No books, no records, no buildings exist that talk about their history and their culture. But the weaves in their fabrics do. These beautiful, elaborate, handmade, you know, weaves that tell histories of entire populations of people. And what I find amazing about this group, AFEDES, in in Guatemala is that they've all come together, these various indigenous groups that all have their different dialect languages, they're in different parts of the country, and they all have their own distinct weaving techniques. And, you know, one of us, we could walk into Zara or H&M right now and buy something that looks like a, you know, Mesoamerican weave or a Guatemalan weave. But it doesn't have that history. It doesn't have that understanding that sits behind it. And so what they've done is this incredible landmark case, which is they've appealed to the international court and to the court of their country to actually give their weaves intellectual property. So in the same way that when you buy champagne, it has to be from the Champagne region of France, it has to be grown in a certain way, a certain type of grape, a certain type of manufacturing technique, and only then can you call it champagne. It's the same way of recognizing that those weaves can't be replicated in factories around the world and mass produced. They have an intellectual property that sits with those indigenous groups around the world. And for me, I think that's the future of fashion, that there is this, those kind of handmade histories and techniques that are really made at the hands of women and girls and small artisan communities around the world. That's our way of saying, you know, we see the work that you're doing. We want to, you know, we want to consume something that holds history, that holds power, that holds memory for you. And it also looks beautiful as well. And by buying it, by investing in it, we are investing in the future of this history and for the generations of indigenous people that are going to come after that. They can be proud that people are wearing their products that are made in an ethical, sustainable way that also upholds these really ancient forms of working, which I think that what they've done is such a great model for what other indigenous groups can do across the world, not only to secure their communities and their livelihoods and the empowerment of their people, but also to give the world these beautiful pieces of fabric or other types of materials that we can use to clothe ourselves, but something that actually honours the development of that textile and doesn't just negate it.
I feel like so many fingers are currently tapping furiously into Google to research these clothes and see how beautiful they are. I know I'm definitely going to have a look when I get home. Let's finish with some fun stuff because we've covered so much ground. Thank you so much for everything you've shared. I would love to know, as I know you're such a foodie, what your three kitchen essentials are. And these are three ingredients that knowing you have them in your kitchen make you feel more relaxed about life.
Oh, so cumin is definitely one. You could get anything, I think. And just with some roasted cumin, some ground cumin, some popped cumin, just changes the whole flavor. So I always have cumin in my kitchen. Salt, I think, as well. Just good pink Himalayan salts can just change things. You can even just have tomatoes or cucumber with just a little bit of salt on top, and it just transforms it. So that's definitely my second. And then my third, you know what? There is a spice mix that my mum makes for me, which is it's called an achar. So achar being a type of pickling set of spices. And I don't know what she puts in it, but I sprinkle that on anything, on a piece of toast, on a bit of fruit, on it. I can put it into my dals, and I can make really quick dals, which is just you soak your lentils, you boil it, and then you just fry off some of this spice mix and add it in. It literally is the most delicious thing. So this achar mix is my third. So it's all spice related, but I'm Indian, so I think that's probably why.
I love that. Okay, how would you feel about a quick fire?
Go for it.
Quick fire with Swati. Breakfast, lunch or dinner?
Lunch.
Tea or coffee?
Tea.
Porridge or toast?
Porridge.
Marmite or jam?
Jam.
Cumin or paprika?
Cumin.
Lemons or limes?
Lemon.
Chili or garlic?
Chili.
Tomato based or coconut based curry?
Tomato based.
Cook at home or go out for dinner?
Cook at home.
The Lion King or Aladdin?
Aladdin.
Sex and the City or Girls?
Girls.
Beer or wine?
Wine.
Chocolate or nut butter?
Chocolate.
Talking or taste buds?
taste buds.
That was very good. That was very quick. Penultimate question. What feeds your soul? This doesn't have to be food related, but this is something that just makes you feel uplifted about life.
I think for me, just sometimes the news can feel so overwhelming with negative stories about what's happening in the world. And honestly, for me, the resilience and the brilliance of what local activists are doing in communities around the world just makes me feel so, so hopeful for the future. And it gives me a real sense of reassurance that even in the face of like the most dire, awful circumstances, you find these incredible local leaders of any age, including young girls, changing the world. Like, for me, that's, there can be no better reassurance that the world's heading in the right way. We just need to give them platform, voice and resources.
Awesome. And finally, what is your death row dinner? And I'm so excited to hear this. Starter, main and dessert.
Oh my gosh. So my starter would be, there's an Indian dish called Pani Puri, which are these kind of like little fried balls, essentially hollow balls. And they're, you put chickpeas and potato and tamarind sauce and pomegranates and lots of spices and fresh coriander. And then you have like a mint tamarind water that fills it up, and you kind of eat them in one go. Like,
I think I had this at yeah. in an Indian restaurant in Shepherd's Bush, weirdly, with the Bosch guys who have been on the podcast. They introduced me. They were so like a taste sensation.
Oh my god, they're amazing. So that's like typical Delhi street food. So I would definitely have Golgappas or Pani Puri as a starter. I just love them. And then I think for a main, it's a toss up between two dishes. So my mum makes this incredible dish that lots of, I'm from Punjab in India, but Punjabis eat Rajma Chawal, which is just rice with curried kidney beans. And it's honestly just heavenly, and it's comfort food. And then my other one from her would be bhature chole, which are these kind of fried fluffy breads that you have with curried chickpeas and then with kind of tamarind onions on the side. So it'd be one or the other, depending on how I'm feeling. And then I'm actually not a major dessert person, so I don't know what my dessert would be.
You could just forego it altogether, but I'd be disappointed not to hear about more of the food that you like.
I think if I did have dessert, there's this one amazing dish actually that you only get in a small part of Old Delhi, and it's called Daulat Ki Chaat, which means, I guess, like nectar of the heavens. And it's sort of made by milk maidens. It's frothed up, sort of unpasteurized ends of sort of the milk. And they sort of mix it with pistachios and with rose water and fluff it. And they lay it out on the rooftops. And it's literally only for about 2 months of the year that you can make this dessert. And they lay it out on the top of the houses around Old Delhi. And actually the moonlight is what froths up the milk into the morning. And it's like really light, it's really airy, and it's just this really specialized dish that, I don't know, for me it makes me think that's, you know, people have been eating that for hundreds of years, and it gives me this connection back to like a foregone history. And it's really special. I think I probably have it maybe once every 2 or 3 years, because I have to be in Delhi at the right time.
I am so glad I pressed you for that answer. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I really hope you enjoyed it. It was such an honor and a privilege for me to sit down with someone as well-informed as Thwaiti. She really is brilliant, and she has so much knowledge around this topic. As always, I will leave links to my brilliant guests in the show notes, and I have a whole back catalogue of episodes for you to enjoy if you're new here. Some favourites for me from this series are Lucy Siegel, Jack Harries and Livia Firth. Some other noteworthy episodes from previous seasons include Dolly Alderton, Clara Amfo, The Happy Pair and Bosch. Thank you again for listening and I hope you're having the most wonderful day. Bye bye!
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.